It's about the income, not particularly the values.
Are you a real estate investor looking to sharpen your skills, or a newbie looking to become one? You're in the right place. Welcome to Where Should I Invest? Real Estate Investing in Canada with your host, Sarah Larby.
Hey guys, welcome back to Where Should I Invest? Real Estate Investing in Canada with Sarah Larby. I hope you guys are starting to see the nice weather. It's about time. I just wanted to give you guys a little bit of a preview, and today we have Don Campbell, who is going to be sharing his many, many years of knowledge and expertise and talking about the current trends, the real estate markets, how he got started. So some really exciting stuff. I'm super impressed with everything that he's done. He's also the author of a few great Canadian books on real estate investing. And if you haven't read them yet, I do suggest that you pick them up and read them because they're very, very informative. Don Campbell is also the founder of RAIN. And for those of you that are involved in the real estate community, you probably have heard of Don Campbell in the past. I also wanted to give you guys a little bit of an update on what I've been doing. And recently I purchased a flip property that is going to be in Brantford, Ontario, and I'm going to be flipping the property with a friend. You know, it's funny how things work out sometimes. I know she had emailed me, she had looked for some properties in Brantford, and there was one specific one that she asked me if I was interested in or if I knew somebody that'd be interested in doing it with her. And my response was, you know, maybe not that one, but if you're looking for a partner, I may be interested, and let's see how we can make this work out for both of us. And we're both millennials, we're both real estate investors. We thought we would actually make it into a fun YouTube show. So our show is actually going to be called Rich Millennial, Poor Millennial. And I'm really looking forward to being able to share the progress of a flip property and how things are progressing or not. You never know. So this house actually closes in just about a little less than a month. So May 15th, we actually get the property, and we are hoping to sell it within a couple months. But I would say one of the most important things is always having different exit strategies. So we actually may end up refinancing and holding it depending on what happens, or we may look at doing some type of other exit strategy, maybe like a rent to own or something along those lines. So we have lots of options, which is really exciting. We purchased this property in Brantford, Ontario. And for those of you that may not know yet, Brantford, Ontario was actually voted the number one best investment or place to buy real estate for 2018, which last year was actually number three. This is moneysense.ca that comes up with these rankings every single year. And this year, Brantford was voted number one, and number two is Peterborough. So it's really exciting, and different companies and different businesses have different ways to look at the results and rank the top cities. And as you will see, Don Campbell, during my interview, he has ranked the top 10 best cities, but it's based on the next 5 years. So while Money Sense magazine will rank them based on the last year and how things have been, they may have some different criterias. And then Don Campbell's has the best 10 towns to invest in, and that's going to be for the next 5 years. So really, really interesting. And if you guys are curious to see if your town has been voted as one of the top cities, then you probably want to listen to that. And the other pieces, you may want to go on moneysense.ca and also review the list that they put together as well. And on another note, I closed on my cottage property this week that I plan on actually renting out on Airbnb starting on June 1st. So right now we're just in the process of updating it, furnishing it, enjoying it, of course, a little bit as well before we start renting it out. But I'm excited about that journey and seeing already some interest. And we've actually rented it now for a couple weeks already. And just by word of mouth, it's really exciting to see how that's all going to play out. So I will keep you guys posted. And the last update is the So Rights Club dates for the Southern Ontario Real Estate Investing Training Club. The next dates are going to be April 26th, which is literally just next Thursday, and followed by May 24th and June 19th. So if you guys want to come out and see what it's all about, get some networking and learn some real estate investing tips and tricks, feel free to either reach out to me at sarah@saralarby.com, or you can actually register on Eventbrite. If you Google SoReight, S-O space R-E-I-T club, it will come up with our events. And in April 26th, we've got Harry Fine, who is a former adjudicator, speaking. And we've got a panel of lenders, and they're going to talk about what they look for in order to lend their money on real estate deals. And we've got a few women investors that are going to be talking about juggling being a mom and being an investor at the same time. So some really interesting stuff. Every single month we try to keep it different and allow for some networking as well. So if you guys haven't come out yet and you want to try, usually $25, but if you guys haven't come out, let me know and I will add you as my free guest for the event. Usually we've got a pretty good turnout, anywhere between about 110 to about 140 people. So really thank you guys, because that's you and that's your support. So definitely a big thank you for coming out month after month and being part of the community. So without further ado, let's listen to the interview with Don Campbell and let us know what you guys think. If you can rate this podcast and provide some comments, it's just greatly appreciated. Thanks so much. So hey guys, today we have Don Campbell, and you might know him from the many, many books that he's written, and also if you've attended RAIN. And I'm really excited, Don, to be talking to you. So thank you so much for making the time to come today and speak to the audience.
It's my absolute pleasure. I think that now, especially now, with all the confusing signals and the government intervention and all the stuff that's going on, I think people need this kind of information more than they ever have before. And that's good. I'm glad we're able to do this.
Excellent. Excellent. So I want to take a step back and ask you about your first real estate investment deal, or how you got started and even why you got started in real estate. Can you share with us?
Sure. I'll do the quick version, because it could be a 2.5 hour discussion, but frankly, didn't know what I was doing. And my friend's father, who was a farmer, explained to us randomly one night while watching a hockey game why he takes his farming profits and puts it into real estate. And these are the 55 reasons why. And Don Cherry's on. We better stop talking about real estate. And that was about it. But it planted a seed for me that I thought, that's not what my mom or dad ever did. This is a kind of a new process. So within a year, his son and I did a joint venture. We were both kind of working part-time. I think he was at Safeway and I was at Sears, and we did a joint venture, dove into the real estate market in Mission, British Columbia. It's 7622 Eider Street in Mission. Yes, I still remember most of my addresses. We really didn't know what we were doing, and we still came out okay. And I have to remember the interest rates were 16%, 15%, 11%. You know, all those different areas, depending on the type of money you're lending or borrowing. So even not understanding economic fundamentals that much and not understanding demographic trends, et cetera, we did well. We bought in the right place or at the right time. And then I stopped buying real estate because it worked. And I'm a dude. And that's what we do. We find something that works, goes, okay, well, let's go find something else that works. And that was lesson number one, is once you find something, make it boring and make it okay to be boring. And if we do that, then you win. But if you're constantly chasing new and exciting new projects so that you can put it on Instagram, you know, that whole thing, that's when you start to get yourself in trouble. Make it boring. Make real estate really boring.
So how long did it take for you to get your second one?
3 years. 3 years later, until I woke up to the fact that, okay, Mr. Smarty Pants, maybe it's time that you went back to the thing that worked. And that's when we started, and then slowly built the portfolio. And that's another key, is you have all the time in the world, no matter what your age, frankly. If you build too quickly, you build it on a foundation of sand. And if you build it slowly and mindfully with thought and with some strategy, you can do incredibly well. The tapping of the brakes, i.e. making sure that you're in control and you're not going too quickly, it has really been a key for a lot of RAIN members. Well, by the way, I don't know if you know, but we just crossed over the $5 billion mark that RAIN members have bought so far in the real estate world in Canada. And that's not their value, that's the actual purchase price. So pretty remarkable that if you just do stick with it and stick with your system and make it boring, it can turn out pretty darn good.
Congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you.
It's amazing.
Yeah, I don't take any credit. I just like being the catalyst. And you know, the catalyst for change and the catalyst for success is a pretty fun role that I've been able to do over the last 26 years.
So Don, there's a lot of investors that want to get into real estate and they tell their friends and they tell their family and they just think that they are the craziest and nothing's going to work and they're going to lose their money. Did you have that when you started and how did you overcome it?
Well, number one is that they're probably right. If you don't do it right and you don't do it with some mindful awareness and a system to follow, the chances of you losing money is pretty damn good. But that's the same thing whether you're investing in real estate or stocks or in bonds or in anything. And that's funny. A lot of people who don't understand the game of real estate and how you play it have a lot of fear about it. So they project their fear onto other people because it's very easy. And I found this out a long time ago. It's very easy to tell people not to do something because there's no risk in it. The risk is in telling people what to do and what, because then you're sitting there going, okay, don't do this, but do this. Now you're being helpful with somebody. But if you're sitting on the sidelines throwing grenades saying, hey, whatever you do, you're going to die. It's going to be terrible. You're going to lose all your money. You're going to be living on the street. That's not helpful for anybody, especially if you've never done it before. If you're just making it up because you saw it in the Globe and Mail, well, you know, it's not very helpful. So how did I overcome it? That's an interesting question because we got to remember that's a long time ago. That's 30 years ago. But even now, you know, I'll just go on the interwebs and see people commenting on my newspaper articles and my videos, et cetera. It's like, oh, you're crazy, man. It's gonna collapse. It's going to collapse. But they have been saying that for the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. And it's true. It goes up, it goes down, it goes up, and it goes down. And what consumers and a lot of those people are making comments and those people who think they're sophisticated but aren't really, what they're constantly doing is they're looking at the value of the property. But if you understand like any good dividend stock or like any investment that provides income, it's about the income, not particularly the values. What's interesting about that is as a consumer, you think everything is about the price that you pay. And I'll frankly, there'll be some $150,000, $200,000 properties that I will not buy because they don't work. But there are some million-dollar properties that I will buy because they do work. It all depends on the location, the expenses, the revenue that it can create. And that's what people don't see. They see, oh my goodness, the average sale price in Toronto is down 22%. That's it, the bubble has burst, run for your life. It may be true, especially in the higher end market. But in that lower end, with all the new mortgage rules and all the new tightening from the federal government to the provincial government to the disincentive, this providing being a landlord, making it very, 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 very tenant oriented. Fewer people are being landlords. Fewer people are then owning a property or a product, I guess, because I look at your rental property as a product and your renters are your customers for that product. You're having a higher increase in demand because a lot of people are staying out of buying the market. And or can't because they don't have any money. So you got a lot more renters right as you're starting to see the number of rentals go down. So in any commodity whatsoever, what that means is that the rents start and the incomes start to go up. So that's good news.
So thanks, Don. That's some really, really good insight. And I've been following you and reading some articles and watching you on the news. And I know that one of your pet peeves seems to be when people ask you about the Canadian real estate market. And you mentioned that there is really no one Canadian real estate markets. So why are people doing that? And I mean, it's everywhere in the news, you know, there's market cycles, there's ups and downs. And so number one, how does somebody stay out of that? And how do they stay out of the fray, as you like to call it?
Yeah, stay out of the fray and you own the day. And that's my saying. And I have to remind myself that every once in a while. Whenever it's kind of like right now, I have cut my grass three times I live in just outside of Vancouver on a rural property. I've cut my grass 3 times. In Edmonton, they're still digging out of the snow. And I think in Toronto, you just kind of recently had another snow. So there's no Canadian weather. There's no Canadian real estate market. Everything is very regional. And that's increasing even more as each province is setting up different rules to try to control the market or whatever they're trying to do. Like in British Columbia, the finance minister actually came out and said, my job is to lower the value of properties in this province. I go, and so what about all your citizens that voted for you that just bought a property? But that's a whole different side. So when I hear Canadian real estate, it makes no sense. Oh, the Canadian real estate market has a bubble. Well, is it potentially in some cities? Possibly it's overvalued, but in other cities, it's perfectly valued. And in even more cities, it's undervalued given the demographics and the economics. So when people say, what do you think of the Canadian real estate market? Which is inevitably the first question I get on an airplane. Oh, you're the real estate guy. What do you think of the real estate market? Which one? Because which one matters? Just like, what do you think of the Canadian weather? Well, which area? So it is a pet peeve, but it also tells me where people are thinking. They're not really thinking as real estate investors. They're thinking as somebody who saw a headline or read a report that said, the Canadian housing market is overvalued. And I have heard that for 2 decades now, that we're overvalued. Now, unfortunately, the federal and provincial governments have heard this, and they want to look like the saviors. It's like everybody's looking to governments this right now in this era as their mommy. Please protect me, mommy, which is very odd because when the market is taking care of them, nobody wants the government around. It's really odd. Anyway, side note. So what we're finding is that when I get that question, what do you think of the Canadian real estate market? It gives me an insight into the depth of the person's knowledge. So if you come to me and you kind of say, so what do you think of the Hamilton real estate market? Or what do you think of the Barrie real estate market? Or even cooler is, what do you think of the Junction neighborhood in Toronto? And when you're asking specific questions, you get specific answers. If you're asking any expert about anything that's general, they're just going to shrug and go, well, here's my bland opinion. And that's not going to serve you, the questioner.
So, Don, some really great points. I saw that you recently were meeting with the Mayor of Toronto's office in the Ministry of Housing. Can you tell us a little bit about those meetings and what you've been able to uncover?
They're secrets.
Oh.
Of course they can. Sitting in the mayor's office gave me some hope. There are some real advocates for both landlords and renters in that market. In that office, it is a big project, given the size of Toronto, to try to find ways at city level to help provide more rental properties into the marketplace. Because that's the conversation we were having. So I went in really skeptical, as you probably know, when I'm dealing with any of these guys. And I left there feeling like there's some hope. Of course, there's an election coming and that could all change after an election. But at the end of the day, there was some intelligent potential post-election, of course, if they get elected again, potential rules and regulations that would help provide more rental properties, which is exactly what the city needs at the moment. So that was good. We got to remember, I meet the federal level, the provincial level, and the municipal level all across this country. So me leading a political meeting with a little bit of hope is kind of rare. So that's good news. They also understand that they got saddled with a lot of rental properties when the provincial government passed them down to the city. And they clearly admit that they're not the greatest landlords in the world. And they have a lot of work to do to clean up all of that housing that they've been handed. And that's great to hear honesty and admittance that, oh my goodness, we have some work ahead of us. Was a real breath of fresh air. I don't vote in Toronto, but I know which way I'd vote after that meeting. Then we went to the Ontario Housing Minister, and very amiable conversation, was interesting. They got a lot of consultation, it seems, from the big boys, the guys who own 5, 10, and 15,000 units in the city, because the answers to some of my questions were not dealing with the people who own 5 or 4 or 3 or 2 rental properties. Brought up the new mandatory lease and showed 3 or 4 different issues that were built into it. And it seemed to be that possibly a couple of those issues were a surprise. But in that meeting, in that closed door meeting, it was an open and rousing discussion. Like there was actual brainstorming that was going on, which was kind of interesting. Lots of notes were taken. We have promised to come back with a bunch of more research. And one of the research pieces that we share with everybody is the CMHC note that talks about purpose-built rental properties, i.e. it could be everything from secondary suites all the way up to purpose-built buildings, that across Canada, the majority of those are owned by individuals or private corporations, which is generally, especially in the rain world, small investors who have just incorporated to own their property. And REITs, et cetera, are such a low percentage. It's quite remarkable. These are CMHC numbers. And when I show that graph to every politician that I talk to, it's like they've never seen that number before. They think that all the landlords are the big bad ones, and the ones that are, that you see on the front of the Toronto Star or Toronto Sun, who are taking advantage of tenants. And one of the questions also I always ask, you'll find that the thing that I do a lot is in situations, I try to formulate the right question because it gets me an actual honest answer, i.e. what's it like in Kingston rather than what's it like in Canada, for instance.
Right.
But in this case, it was more along the lines of, so let's admit that 10% of all landlords across the country are not very good. They're either purposely not good and mean, or they're just unaware. And we all agreed, right? Including the minister. Mm-hmm. And I said, but can we not say that about every industry? I'm thinking that there's 10% of inspectors who aren't great. I let in, by the way. Inspectors that aren't great. There's probably 10% car salesmen that aren't great. I think there's 10% in every industry. Would you say that there are at least 10% of politicians are not great at what they do and or are in it for themselves? And the answer is obviously yes, but I didn't ask him to name names because a lot of them are quite obvious. But that's another lesson that I think the listeners can take, is that when you're having an interesting conversation, a conversation where you're not getting through, i.e., listen, most of the landlords are small landlords, and most of the landlords, small landlords, don't need all your regulation because it's adding more expense, and they're just going to sell their property, and they're not going to rent anymore, and then you're going to have a rental property. And if the other side's not hearing it, then you just kind of turn it around and turn the conversation around to, for instance, let's all admit that there's 10% of landlords that are really crappy and take advantage of tenants. Let's also admit, whoever you're talking to, whatever industry they're in, that 10% of politicians are also in that same similar situation. And as a matter of fact, I will guarantee you that there's crossover, that there are some politicians who are terrible landlords. And then what that does is it awakens the other party's thought process, that so many of them live in a silo, a thought silo. And what we can do by having those kind of correlation conversations is break that silo so they can see that what they're trying to solve is an insolvable problem. And maybe that we should just start assisting the winners instead of tying the hands of the winners and start enforcing the current bylaws and laws on the bad guys. That was my mission on this Ottawa and Toronto political journey, this trip.
So did you reach out to them or did they reach out to you?
I reached out to feds and the Ontario Ministry, and I think the mayor's office was the one who instigated the conversation with us. Now we have a commitment from the provincial. I know there's an election coming up and that could change once again, but the provincial to lean in and start using us as consultants on any of their future stuff, including they've asked us for some specific research that we're glad to do and glad to provide them to help the small mom and pop landlords.
So I want to thank you on behalf of probably every single real estate investor landlord, because it takes somebody like you, and thank you for awakening them, because a lot of what's been going on this year has been more punches against us when, like you said, I think 90% of us want to do the best that we can. We want to treat
our tenants, with our clients, as well as possible to make sure that they have a nice home. And it is really surprising that that's what it takes to be able to wake them up, for them to realize that we are not big businesses and we are not all bad landlords. So I do want to thank you. And I also, it's definitely an eye opener that most of them just don't, unfortunately, know what they're doing. And when it comes to real estate, they're coming up with these, and, you know, I don't want to get into the politics, but all these rules and regulations without really understanding the consequences and doing the proper research or getting the proper consultants to be able to make those decisions and those changes to make sense for their goals and everyone's goals.
Well, there's two things within that statement. And number one is every single one of us, not just me, when we see an issue, i.e. like the new federal tax, we had a change there, right? We got that change done, that they were going to do passive income at some 73% or some insane number. And that didn't happen in the federal budget because of all the lobbying that went on. It's the same thing that every single landlord needs to, and property owner needs to do, is pay really close attention to what's happening in their industry, especially at government level, and be heard. I'll tell you, it's the power of a well-written email or letter, not a, you're bad, you know, those kind of, they just ignore those, I'll tell you that right now. But anything that has some structure and some, hey, listen, if you do this, this is the unintended consequences of this, and it's actually going to hurt the what you're trying to hurt and save rather than help them. And because the one thing that we all need to know is that lobbyists are incredibly loud and incredibly strong. And if there is, for instance, a lobbyist for a certain type of housing, i.e. giant multifamily or whatever it is, they're going to be loud and they're going to lobby for things that are more pro big business than the mom and pop. But if you've got mom and pops who are voting and mom and pops who live in certain wards or in certain electoral districts being politely strong to say, you know what, you got to think, you got to really think this through. And by the way, you're hurting XYZ with that. We can make a difference. I've seen it this year, especially at the federal level, because they live in silos as well. And they're surrounded by lobbyists. You can break through as an individual, but it's got to be a well-written note and it's got to be to the right person. And if there's lots of them and lots of us who have that same opinion, then they wake up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. We can't just be sitting here twirling our thumbs and complaining to the person next door and not doing anything about it. And I think you said it well.
That's the Canadian way. Mm-hmm. The Canadian way is to point and go, that's terrible. How dare they? And then they'll have to go and go snowboarding or whatever they do.
Right.
Or the Leafs game, right? It's funny that it only takes a little bit of tiny bit of extra effort, like 5%, you know, especially now that we have the internet. When we were doing this at the beginning, the internet wasn't a way to communicate. So we're writing actual letters to stick in a stamp on it, mailing it to Ottawa, mailing it to City Hall, you know, that kind of thing. Now you can do it relatively quickly and have a much more impact. And I suggest the more finger pointing and moaning and groaning that we do, the less they're going to listen to us until we start moaning and groaning to them in a polite fashion.
Yeah, absolutely. So I do want to ask you about all the news about millennials and millennials struggling to buy their house, their properties, living in their parents' basement. Like, was that a topic of conversation? And if not, what are your thoughts on it regardless?
Well, it was a topic of conversation for sure, because I think that the demographic right now, the demographic shift that's occurring, you know, 27% of the population in the country are millennials. Well, that's the same as the baby boomers, about 26-27% baby boomers in the country. So what that's telling me is that, as you know, baby boomers was the largest cohort of human beings ever to go through an economy. We're about to witness that all again. And the demand for housing, especially when you couple on top of it the current federal government mandate of bringing in 333,000 people from outside the country into the country, into Canada, every year for the next 4 years or 3 years. And at the same time as we've got this pressure from the millennials who are, a lot of them can't afford to buy where they want to live, i.e. Toronto, Vancouver, you know, the hot spots. So once they finally get out of mom and dad's basement, what's happening is they are becoming renters instead of home buyers. And some of them are going to stay that way by choice, but others will want to eventually own a property. That's going to push them out further. And that's where the magic of GO Train and the magic of TTC, et cetera, is going to play a role in providing these people with opportunity to get into a housing market that is relatively more affordable and not have to drive on the freeway. You know, that I looked up a stat once and there were more people on the freeways in the GTA. Yeah, it was more people on the freeway at GTA at rush hour than lived in Saskatchewan.
Oh, wow.
So you look at people just are getting fed up. So hence the GO Train expansion. So a number of the top towns are definitely driven by the future and what transit could be occurring, because frankly, that's where people are going to end up. And the millennials, the other thing that's happening is the millennials are the highest percentage of people, a cohort, getting help from their parents to buy a property. And why is that? Well, the baby boomers have done, you know, generally, they've done very well financially. They've done very, very well if they own real estate during their lifetime. So now they have this store of wealth. And frankly, 5% of them are really sick of having their kids in the basement. And what they're doing is they're doing joint venture deals and or gifting down payments with their millennial kids. And that's why you're seeing a dramatic increase. I don't have the number right in front of me, unfortunately, but there's a dramatic increase in uninsured mortgages, so non-CMHC. Usually, if you've got a young cohort like the millennials entering into a marketplace, you would see a lot of CMHC insured mortgages because the down payments are lower. But the increase is really in the uninsured, and that's a really indicator of this joint venture or family estate or inheritance that's occurring between the baby boomers and the millennials, which is helping them get into the marketplace. It's a really, really, really interesting time, because in my book, The Secrets of the Canadian Real Estate Cycle, on chapter 5, we talk all about all of the influencers. So the influencers are the things that kick the market off of its cycle. And one of the things that's not in there is baby boomers helping their kids, because when the book was written, that wasn't really a trend. I would now, if I was to rewrite that book, I would add that into that chapter. And I do recommend anybody who's investing, reread chapter 5 if you have the book, just as a reminder as to how to read what's going on right now.
So yeah, Don, I think it's a really good point. And I do want to also ask you, and you mentioned the different towns and the top 10 towns, and looking at the trends, you did a great report at Acre. So every year, Don and his team have a 2.5-day intensive real estate investing seminar, and it's very, very educational. And this year it was awesome because you went through the top 10 towns in Ontario in this case, and where they actually are in the market cycle based on that book. So do you mind just briefly sharing a little bit about the top 10 towns across Canada and where some of them might be in the cycle and just some things to look for?
Sure. Why don't we start in Ontario? You have to understand, we don't just pick markets because A, we have something for sale there or something, because I'm not a realtor, so that's not my job. I'm frankly a geek, a stats geek, who then turns those stats into really good investment decisions. So we analyzed 38 different economic and demographic fundamentals when we're looking at cities all across the country. And then we boil it down and then we argue. I mean, we discuss politely, but we argue as to what their rankings are going to be, because there is a little bit of subjectivity near the end. And we come up with the top investment towns that are going to outperform other cities over the next 5 years. They may underperform in 2018, but by 2023, which is the 5-year mark, you are going to see that they outperform the majority of the province. That's the fun bit, but it's also the stressful bit, because, you know, you say you put a town out and then it doesn't do very well for 2 years. People are going, oh, it's wrong. How dare you? But we stick with our guns because we know what our research is like. And inevitably they come back up and overperform based on a combination of demographic and economic conditions. So if you go down into Ontario, you know, we've got So say, for instance, let's go number four. Very interesting. I remember the first time that we talked about number four, which is Barrie, Ontario. It was at least 10, 11, 12 years ago when it snuck on to number 10. And people going, are you crazy? Have you seen it? It's just cabin country. And we were able to see the demographic trends, the political trends, and the economic trends that were going on there. And now it's sitting at number four. And it's serviced by GO Train. Once again, a transit thing that is a theme currently. It's serviced by GO Train. The GO Train's expanding. It goes right down to Union Station. So you've got people who are living there for their lifestyle. Alternately, number three is Hamilton. And now it's a bigger city, obviously. And it had, especially a few years ago, when I was on the hours, George Strombolopoulos, when I can still remember the story, and I still remember the moment when he said, so Don, you got a bunch of money, you're going to put it into Ontario, where would you put it? And I said, Hamilton, and the camera was on me, not on him. And the look on his face was of, are you kidding me? Now, of course, he's a fan of Hamilton and understands it and sees it. But at that time, we were looking at the past. We were looking at the future, and we could see it happening. Now you've got lots of people who've moved out of Toronto into Hamilton due to price, due to funkiness, and the arts community has moved into there. The steel town still has some steel there, but nowhere near as much as it used to be. And you're seeing a real expansion of McMaster University. So you're seeing the GO Train, once again, is also playing a role in there. So that's Ontario, and that's number three. Number two is the Kitchener-Waterloo-Cambridge triangle. High tech, lots of jobs, like lots of empty jobs. If you don't have a job, go there, by the way. And lots of empty jobs, great universities that are having spin-off of small companies, many of which turn into much larger companies, and vibrant millennial lifestyle there. It's really cool. And they are about to be the smallest, I think it's the smallest population base to have an LRT, which is once again really important to millennials, et cetera, LRT system in North America. And so that's pretty cool. The smallest center to see the future and then the requirement for an LRT. So that's good. And the number one place is really interesting. And number one in Ontario it's never been number one before, but given the political climate, the demographics, the prices, the rents, the transportation expansion, the densification, Ottawa turned into the number one place in all of Ontario. And that was really a surprise, and people go, how are you surprised?
Right.
I said, because when we go into research, we don't have a mandate to try and then try and back it up with research. We let the research tell us where the towns are and where things are. And that's why every once in a while, a surprise will pop in and kind of go, wow, I thought Ottawa would be like five, but it's actually number one.
So how long does it take to put that research together?
Oh my goodness. multiple months. You know, the team gets right into it. There are spreadsheets that go forever. You're scrolling up and down on those spreadsheets and across forever and ever. We've got some really cool algorithms, and it takes months to put together.
So just out of curiosity, like, what are some of the top two or three sources that somebody can pull if they do want to get some updated information?
Well, if you go into that, and I'm not trying to pitch my book, because I'm leaving all those ads after humanity, so thank you if you buy my book. But in the Secrets of the Canadian Real Estate book, we tell you exactly the sources, exactly what questions to ask, exactly a bunch of the fundamentals that you should be studying. But StatsCan is good on some things, but other things, they're very, very far behind. If you go to the economic development offices of many of the towns, great opportunity, great source. Real estate boards are good, but in Ontario, they're strangely very protective of their data and they're sending out. Every other jurisdiction just kind of posts it online on a daily basis. Okay, here's how many sales, etc. But it's a little bit more pulling teeth in Ontario, which is really an odd thing. So as we work through, we refine who we trust and who we know is a bit of a blowhard. But the local newspapers are really quite interesting. It's usually not the headlines that you're looking for. It's the smaller stories where hey, we're a new company's coming to town and they're going to be hiring another 92 people. Where they move from? I want to know where they move from and where they're moving to. And is it near LRT? Is it, what kind of jobs? Are they high paying jobs or are they like call center jobs? And so all of those different things after 26 years of doing this almost become intuitive.
Okay, some great insights. So I want to ask you a little bit about yourself. You have a little bit of time for that? Perfect.
So I can hide behind economics all you want, but you're talking about me now? Uh-oh. Go ahead.
Well, I think it's important to also let the audience know, because you've done so many things and you have, you know, so much credibility, and you know, you've written some books and they're excellent, excellent books. I've read them. And I think even just the real estate cycles, that's probably one of those books that you want to reread and reread, because as the cycles change, you're going to look at it again and you're going to get more insights from it. So what does your real estate portfolio look like today, Don?
That's interesting. I have everything, I think. So I have condos, which are very strong. I have condo buildings, like small apartment buildings, like 20, 25 uniters. I have light industrial. I have no retail on purpose. And I am heavily into agriculture land in BC's Lower Mainland. So the agriculture land I know is not a moneymaker. I get it. It's more of a project and food miles, eating healthy, helping my friends, family, and community eat healthy is one of my passions. And so that's what the ag land is. So I do have quite a diverse, but I started with really good townhouses, which you would call semis, townhouses and condos, because they're really easy to manage. And then as I expanded, I got single family homes with suites. And then as I expanded, I got apartment buildings, like those 20 kind of unit size, but they were all based on, and they were all purchased based on the economic and demographic fundamentals, not pre-sale. Never bought a pre-sale, because that's more speculating than investing in my world. People have done very, very well. But right now with the new mortgage rules, people are starting to come to the reality that sometimes the music stops when you don't want it to stop. So I always like to buy something that exists and then renovate it, make it rent ready. And haven't sold a whole lot throughout my whole career. It's more of buy and just hang on to it and let the tenants pay the mortgage down, whether it's industrial or light industrial or residential. That's my portfolio. I'm very happy with it. Do I every once in a while end up with a dog in there? Absolutely. And then I just reposition it, i.e. renovate it or market it better or fix it. And I have bought, when I haven't paid attention to my own system is always when I make the mistakes. And I have bought a couple of properties when I fell in love with the property instead of fell in love with the economics and the demographics and the numbers. And those are the ones that I ended up having to sell because it was a really stupid purchase. But I really wanted it. You know, we talk ourselves into things and we all make mistakes. And our job is to get over it when we make mistakes and not hold ourselves back from the next deal.
Yeah, absolutely. So just out of curiosity, so a lot of great insight. I mean, I can ask you lots of questions even about retail and et cetera, but just out of curiosity, how are you holding all these properties? What's your strategy?
My giant shoulders. No, kidding. Like, what do you mean by how am I holding them? How am I managing them? It's somebody else.
The management part, but even just the more specifically the financing part. So are you working with partners? Or are you doing joint venture deals? How's that all work?
I did a lot of joint venture deals for the first 10 years. And I am trying to think if I have 3 joint venture deals left in my whole portfolio, because I don't need to anymore, because I've been doing this for a long time and have generated enough equity within my property and my portfolio to be able to buy out my joint venture partners. They've left very happy and I have the property on my own. That's generally how I'm doing it now. And now when I'm buying a property, it's just Connie and I guess my wife of 30 years, she's a kind of a joint venture partner in everything. Right. So I have to acknowledge that, but that's how we do it. The joint venture, the very first property, like I said, in the very beginning of this conversation, was a joint venture. Joint ventures have done me very, very well the the lessons within it are, make sure you you choose a partner who has the opposite of what you have. If you don't have any money, don't go partner with somebody else who doesn't have money. Yeah, that's just silly. And I see people do that all the time. It's interesting. And then they all run around trying to find money. It doesn't make sense. And make sure that everything is documented. If it's not written down, it doesn't exist. And it's very difficult. Or no, it's very easy to skip doing the writing of the agreements and the legal. Oh my goodness, this is going to cost us $1,500. I can't believe it. During the honeymoon phase, which is the start and the excitement of the buying of the property, and you're getting together, we're going to do this together. It's amazing. But 2, 3, 5, however many years down the road, when an issue comes up, if you don't have a document that is full and complete, it can get really ugly very quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and you're speaking right to me, because I had a call with George Duby. So I'm doing my first joint venture with another investor. We found a property. So we're just going to try to make sure that all of our T's are crossed and our I's are dotted, and it is going to cost money. But like you said, it is the honeymoon phase and everything is great now, but we need to make sure that if something does go wrong, then everything is written down on paper and we both are in agreement with the process.
Design the divorce in advance of getting married. That's the joint venture agreement.
Absolutely. Just out of curiosity, so was Connie into real estate right away? Like, how did you guys
kidding?
Just together years.
No, but she has the bookkeeper mind. So she trained as an accountant. Gotta remember, we got married, she was 20. Oh my goodness, I just told everybody her age now. She loves the math and she loves the bookkeeping and keeping all the receipts, keeping me in line when I'm not remembering receipts. And that's the part that she fell in love with more than the real estate and the real estate deals. She left that. I don't like that part at all. I'm not wired for that. So we've made an incredibly great team and I've been blessed with that. Okay, Don. Off you go. You can go do that. Go make money. And I'll keep the home fires burning, so to speak, and make sure that the accounting's all done and work with the accountants themselves. She's very good at that. So that's how that's all come together.
It's very, very complimentary. I am kind of like you where it comes to taxes and paperwork. I just hate it. I'm glad you found somebody that loves it. How long did it take you to, from your first property, to become full-time? Was it a progression or did you decide to quit your job and just get into real estate full time? How did that go?
Never. I've never been full time. If you're full time in real estate, you're doing it wrong. If it takes you to find properties and manage properties or manage the managers, et cetera, more than 2 hours a day, there's a problem. You're in the wrong game. If you're a realtor, they should be fully doing it full time, obviously, because that's your job. But number one, don't quit your day job because banks love it if you have a job and they will give you more mortgages. Kind of important. Number two is, I don't know what you would do for 22 of the hours of the day other than the 8 that you sleep, because you can become obsessed with real estate, or you can understand that real estate is just a financial tool that gets you to an end game, whatever that end game is for yourself. Everybody defines their own. And it is so funny how people become so involved. Everything about their life and their working life is real estate. It's almost creepy how it becomes an obsession. But I guess it's the same thing with Bitcoin. I think it's the same thing as option trading, etc., is that people get dragged in. I look at real estate as a means to an end, and I want to be efficient. And that's why that Acre weekend that you just attended that we do, we are really clear that a lot of the systems are built to save you a bunch of time, so that you can have a life. We call it the rain life, where you actually have some fun and some balance, and not every word that comes out of your mouth is real estate oriented. So I've never been a full-time real estate investor. I've always been doing something else, whether it's rain or research or writing books or traveling. We take a lot of vacation. We've always taken a lot of vacation since the day we were married. Even though we had no money when we started, I think we had $585 in the bank account.
Wow.
Yeah. And still went to Hawaii, the idiot kids that we were, and made that a priority and just really repositioned real estate in our head as a means to an end. That served us very, very well.
Yeah, that's really well said, because it's not, it shouldn't be about the real estate specifically, but what can it create for your life? So let's just say, for example, somebody has a 5-year plan and they want to travel and have the freedom, or they have a 10-year plan to do this and they want to do it by using real estate investing and cash flow to create that. Is there like a strategy that you would recommend that they do for a 5-year and a 10-year plan?
Sure. Real Estate Investing in Canada book is 240 pages of a strategy. And here it sounds like I'm selling my book, you know, which I'm not. But I write these things for a reason. I don't write them for fun because I don't make any money on them because it all goes to charity. Everyone's plan is going to be different. It all depends on how much time you have, how much money you have, how much you like people, and what your end goal is. You know, you have to, it's a whole combination of all of the different variables that we all have in our life. So if you have a fair bit of capital saved, you can accelerate the process. You can be very strategic. Here's one thing for sure that anybody who's buying is make sure you talk to somebody like on the buying group who knows the new banking rules. Because if you go to the easy bank first, it may preclude, like for your first mortgage, it may preclude you when you start to hit your third or fourth mortgage from getting a third or fourth mortgage because you went to the wrong financial institution at the start. And that's not good. That's very frustrating. A lot of people don't know that. As a matter of fact, a lot of mortgage brokers don't know that and aren't as strategic. It's like a chess game, which banks, credit unions, financial institutions that you use and in what order. So that's a strategy in and of itself. But patience is important. Don, I can't find any properties that work in this area. I'm going to take a risk and go in and it's going to be $500 a month negative cash flow. I hear that all the time. And I say, well, I'm sorry, but you're insane. Because what are you going to do? Go get a second job to pay for your investment negative cash flow? That doesn't make any sense to me. Real estate's supposed to fund your life, not become your life. So patience is important. If I had that 10-year window, which is a perfectly fair, like, if we were 5 years ago, I would say you could do it in 5 years. Now, given all the government regulations and the federal government doing everything they possibly can to make it difficult for people to buy real estate, even though they say they're trying to help middle class, that's a whole different story. What we're finding is that it's going to take you a little bit longer because markets are going to be a little bit slower. So you have to be much more strategic. If you do that and you start from the beginning, the first year you should not buy anything. The first year you should just study and analyze and retrain your brain to think like a sophisticated investor rather than a consumer. So you look at research, you analyze research, you go, where's the demand going to be in the future geographically? Okay, so who's going to move into that property? Okay, so it's going to be young millennials or seniors or whatever your target is. All right, so what kind of amenities do they need to be close to? So you narrow it down. You really spend a year picking your spot and picking your strategy and getting your financials in order with a really good investment-oriented mortgage broker. You've talked to your accountant. But Don, I don't have an accountant. You're going to get an accountant very soon, very early, and get yourself set up so that when the time comes, you're making smart, strategic decisions instead of just winging it and making stuff up. So that would be my plan, is you sharpen the saw for a year and then you start cutting that tree.
You've mentioned so many great pieces of advice. And one of the things that I did too as a mistake when I first got started is I did go to that bank, and that bank gave me a mortgage for my rental property. And they were also doing my residence at that time, the primary residence. And then I went back for a second rental and they started asking me for like 25% down. And then when I wanted to do my third rental, they wanted 35%. And then I figured out that that's not normal. I met a really awesome mortgage broker and then I had to untangle the mess. So it is so much easier, like you said, just take a year to learn it and learn it well and set your team up properly so that you don't have to untangle the mess. And buying cash flowing properties, I mean, I'm all about that. That is probably my first rule that I would, you know, I would never buy something that costs me $500 a month. And I really hope that, you know, if there's one thing that people can remember is just buy something that's cash flow positive. It is so much easier to scale and to get to your goals when you're not having to use your income from your work to pay down the difference for that rental property.
That's not just being smart, it's also being strategic, because banks are going to see, why do these people own these negative cash flow properties? I don't want to fund them again for a third one because they're crappy at what they're doing. And so if you actually have goals that you want to achieve, then you have to be strategic and mindful from the very start. And unfortunately, people aren't like that. You know, there's enough surveys out there to show that people make more, they spend more time planning their vacations than they do planning their investments, which is a bit odd when you think about it.
I've read that, and that's pretty sad.
Yeah, well, it's very consumer mentality. That's just kind of the way that it is with the average consumer. But if you want to be average, you know, you can do that. But I don't think that anybody listening to this podcast wants to think like everybody else. You know, it doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're almost out of time. We have about 3 minutes left. And I wanted to take a moment just to ask you some lightning round questions. So I have a series of 5 questions and you can answer them in the first answer that comes to your mind. And they should be about, you know, 20 seconds each. You ready?
Blue. No, okay. We have to ask a question first. Okay, good.
All right, perfect. So number one, what is your favorite real estate investing book ever?
Well, that's kind of tough to say because The Real Estate Cycle is my book, and that sounds really arrogant. But writing that book, I learned the most. And what's really interesting, back in the 1990s, there was this thing called Nothing Down for the 90s by Robert Allen. Mm-hmm. That was really quite interesting as well.
Are you working on a book right now, a new book?
Nope, I'm not.
Question number two, what is your favorite podcast?
Tim Ferriss podcast is my favorite go-to when I am cognizant, when I'm going to sleep. I like How Stuff Works. And The Everyday Millionaire is also one that I really, really am beginning to enjoy, one that Patrick puts out. And, oh, and yours too. Yes, of course. Yes, yours. That's what I'm supposed to say, right?
No, you don't need to say that. I'm just curious. Okay. What you
think. But yeah, my go-to really, and Hardcore History. For us history buffs, Dan Carlin, it's amazing. Each podcast is 3 to 4 hours long and thoroughly engaging if you're into history.
Okay, excellent. So what about your favorite pastime? So question number three, what do you do for fun when you're not doing real estate or working on rain or analyzing? What do you like to do when it has nothing to do with real estate?
Three things. Travel to new and interesting places with my lovely wife. We love, love, love that. Number two is playing and listening to music, studying music. And number three is driving my tractor, because there's nothing that can go wrong when you're driving your tractor. The whole day gets good.
Awesome. I love it. Number four, if you lost all your money or your assets tomorrow, how do you start again?
Exactly the same way. I would start with it back into real estate. I would do joint ventures and I would find a way to have a positive impact on the world.
Excellent. And question number five. So if somebody came to you and they had $50,000 and they want to know how to get started, what do you say to them?
It's not a lot of money. So what you want to do is you want to get into a market that is smaller, but make sure that it's well supported. But before all of that, I would ask them the question, what is your goal with that money? Is it capital appreciation or is it income replacement? Because once I know that, then I know which direction in which to point them.
Okay, perfect. So that was our lightning round questions. I have two final questions. Where can listeners find you to learn more about you?
Oh, they can go to donrcampbell.com or they can follow me on Facebook, which is The Rain Man, not Rain Man, but The Rain Man with an E, Rain, R-E-I-N, and on Twitter at donrcampbell.
And perfect. So any last final words of advice or anything else that you'd like to let the listeners know before we wrap this up?
Yes, it's be patient, be mindful in everything that you do. Be grateful to everybody that helps you along the way and have some gratitude for the person who serves you at the grocery store all the way up to the person who mentors you. Smile more, laugh more, and find a way to manage your energy, whether it's through music or comedy. The world's not a pretty place at the moment, and we all need to find ways in which to at least get some positive endorphins into us through laughter, friendship, good food. And the more we do that, the less angry the world becomes.
Amazing. Well, on that note, thank you very much, Don Campbell, for being on Where Should I Invest with Sarah Larby. Thank you so much.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to Where Should I Invest with your host, Sarah Larby. Make sure to listen in next time. We'll catch you on the next episode of Where Should I Invest?